On This Week in Enterprise Tech, do you think about testing your applications and solutions before delivering it to users? Well, we have a really great roundtable. We talk about UAT testing or user acceptance testing. Really great discussion. You should check that out. Plus, paying ransomware demands could land you in hot water with the feds. Curtis is going to take us through that. And is it time for you to turn over your email for another solution that can help with better collaboration? Well, we have Nick Steck. He's the COO of WorkStorm here to show us a path forward. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing employees simple and secure, even when they are working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 413, recorded October 2nd, 2020, The Death of Email. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Thinx Canary. Detect attackers on your network by avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, especially with everything else you have to consider today. But there's one place where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twyatt. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And by IT Pro TV. If you're looking to expand your IT career or improve the skills of your IT team, you need IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world, the enterprise. And we have quite the show today. And what better way to start it by bringing in the experts to guide us through it all, starting with our own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
Oh, it's another beautiful week here in the Sunshine State. Actually, fall arrived and at least teased us a little bit this week. We had some highs that actually stayed in the 70s, some lows down in the 60s. So the promise of fall in the air. I'm in a good mood and ready to enjoy a great episode of Twyatt.
Me too, me too. Now, you're getting a little bit of running in too. You have some new kicks.
Yeah. I'm back running, trying to get somewhere between, 4 and 6 miles a day and seeing if we can't build up. There's a nice little half marathon that's happening in real space later this year rather than just being a virtual event. And I'm really hoping I can be ready to get out and run with at least a few hundred of my running friends here in the city beautiful late this year.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. Thanks for being here, Curtis. Well, speaking of busy, he's our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chibert. How are you, my friend? What's keeping you busy this past week?
I'm obviously still packing and doing all kinds of stuff. I'm still working a bit with the Department of Public Safety on trying to improve the campus security systems to make it a safer place for my nieces and nephews. But I just got a plaque in the mail, and I can now talk about it. It is a little hard to see because of the ring light. There
you go. Look at that. It's beautiful.
It is from the Society for Applied Spectroscopy, and it's for a grant project we did called a two-component approach to long-range remote Raman and laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy using low laser pulse energy, published in Applied Spectroscopy Journal, Volume 73, Issue 3. In a nutshell.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell me about that, because that sounds very interesting.
Yeah. I designed two drones. One was a wheeled vehicle, and had a big equipment platform for batteries, cameras, radios, blah, 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 and a mirror on a tilt pan unit so that we could take a big laser turret. Well, not so big. We're only talking a couple milliwatts that could be up to a couple hundred meters away, almost 300 meters. And we shine it at the mirror. It bounces down and hits the ground. And a camera mounted on there will then measure the, send the video back to the base station where a computer analyzes the backscatter. So we could determine whether or not we could find buried nitrates, especially because a spinoff grant is going to be used for finding unexploded ordnance in war zones. The second vehicle was a drone where we do the same thing, but up to basically a quarter mile offshore, because the United States, in their ultimate wisdom, decided to dump mustard gas shells off the Hawaiian Island shores. Not all of them were documented. So the documented ones were good. Our ships have gone out. We've pulled up the shells. And in a special lab, sealed lab on our research vessel, we actually had micro furnaces to burn the mustard gas. All fine and good. Unfortunately, a lot of them weren't documented, and that's where our drone comes in. We're going to mow the lawn and measure the backscatter off the ocean surface to detect dissolved mustard gas, and then map where they are, and hopefully bring them up and make it safer for people to skin dive and scuba dive off the Hawaiian Islands.
It's amazing. Now, you do some amazing stuff that really impact great causes. How long did it take you to develop such a solution?
My portion was teeny tiny. My design work only took a couple of months. Okay. But the project's been going on for 3 years now.
Wow.
2-3 years. And this is only phase one. Phase two spins off what's going to be a vehicle-mounted system with a armored ROV to possibly go into Fallujah.
Right.
We shall see if that grant goes. And then the larger drone hopefully will fly next year.
Very cool. Very cool. Cool. Congratulations, Chibert. Well, folks, speaking of fun stuff, we have quite the show today. A lot of enterprise news coming in. Now, does your organization think about testing for your users before you deploy your applications and solutions? Well, we have a nice roundtable discussion about just how effective user acceptance testing is and just how you can actually use that in your environment. Plus, paying ransomware demands could actually land you in hot water with the feds. Curtis will take us through that. And is it time for you to turn over your email for a much better collaboration solution that might just evolve your business workflows to be more productive? Well, Nick Steckier is here. He's the CEO of WorkStorm, and he's here to show us a path forward. But before we get to all those exciting things, we have to jump into this week's news blips first. Now, it wouldn't be an enterprise week without some nefarious hacker activity. A hacker group previously associated with the North Korean administration launched spear phishing attacks to compromise United Nations Security Council's members. Now, the attacks disclosed in a UN report last month have taken place this year and have targeted at least 28 UN officials, including to at least 11 individuals representing six countries of the UN Security Council. Now, the attacks look to be the North Korean hacker group known in the cybersecurity community by the codename of Kimsuki. Now, according to the UN report, Kimsuki operations took place across March and April this year and consisted of a series of spear phishing campaigns and aimed at the Gmail accounts of UN officials. Now, the emails are designed to look like UN security alerts or requests for interviews from reporters to try to convince officials to access the phishing pages or run malware files on their system. Now, the country that reported the Kimsuki attacks to the UN Security Council found evidence of similar campaigns against government members, with some of the attacks taking place via WhatsApp, not just email. Now, these attacks did not stop in April, though. As stated in the most recent UN report of North Korea, the Kimsuki group has continued to target the UN as part of its broader efforts to spy on UN decision-making regarding North Korean affairs and possible plans on imposing new sanctions. Now, the past several years have proven anything about cybersecurity, it's the large geopolitical organizations need to be especially aware of the risk and impact of cyber threats. Let's hope they start focusing on it more in the near future.
Well, there's a new HP bug bounty program targeting vulnerabilities in printer cartridges. Numerous studies in recent years, including one by the NCC group last year and another by Cyber News in August involving the hijacking of some 26,000 devices worldwide, have highlighted the risk to organizations from having vulnerable printers connected to the network. The surge in teleworking from the coronavirus outbreak has exacerbated those concerns significantly. In response, HP this week launched a new bug bounty program designed to uncover potential vulnerabilities in printers featuring what the company described as its office-class print cartridges. Under the program, HP has invited a small group of white hat hackers with specific expertise in print technology to take a crack at its printer cartridge tech. Each hacker will receive an agreed-upon base fee plus $10,000 for every vulnerability they discover. Crowdsourced vulnerability coordination firm BugCrowd will manage HP's new bounty program. HP's new bug bounty program is the second on printer security that it launched in recent years. In July 2018, the company launched a program similar to the one disclosed this week, except that it was focused on potential vulnerabilities in the printer itself. The 2018 bug discovery initiative resulted in nearly 40 vulnerabilities being discovered and reported to HP.
Well, augmented reality could be the geology classroom's killer app. One of the most important challenges in teaching geology is bringing the outside world into the classroom. During a pandemic, obviously an inability to safely bring students into the classroom doesn't make that any easier. Fortunately, digital tools can provide new ways to access the world beyond whichever room you find yourself in. Geology is a very spatial science and can require a lot of 3D visualization. Simple physical models, not to mention rocks, have been long used to aid teaching about things like faults or crystalline mineral structure. But these things can be surprisingly costly and occupy a surprisingly large amount of storage space. Well, this is an obvious place where technology can come in, serving up an endless variety of objects, simulations, and real-world data, if there is an easy way for students to access it. Well, I helped run a Martian geology class on my then brand new ultra high def video wall, and being able to display huge images from satellites, landers, and such was a huge boon to the learning process. But I have to imagine augmented reality could have an even greater impact by letting every student see the geology in context. Awesome.
Now, nuclear fusion has always been that of science fiction. It's the sci-fi technology that powers exploration of the stars, has always been a dream of scientists alike. But just recently, it seems that it might be more reality than we think. A group of scientists recently published a set of research papers explaining the possibility of developing a compact version of a nuclear fusion reactor. The paper's contents have renewed hopes that the long, elusive goal of mimicking the way the sun produces energy could be achieved and could assist in the fight against climate change. Now, construction of a reactor called Spark, which is being developed by researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a spinoff company called the Commonwealth Fusion Systems, is expected to begin next spring and take 3 or 4 years. Now, fusion, in which lightweight atoms are brought together at temperatures of tens of millions of degrees to release energy, has been held out as a way for the world to address the climate change implications of electricity production. Now, like a conventional nuclear fission power plant that splits atoms, a fusion plant would not burn fossil fuels and it would not produce greenhouse gas emissions either. But its energy, usually isotopes of hydrogen, would be far more plentiful than the uranium used in nuclear power plants, and fusion would generate less and less dangerous radioactive and waste that fission plants do. But the hurdles to building a machine that can create and control fusion plasma, a rolling ultra-hot cloud of atoms that will damage and destroy anything it touches, are quite big. Now, Spark employs a donut-shaped chamber inside which the fusion reaction takes place. Because the plasma cloud is so hot, hotter than sun, it must be confined by the magnetic forces. Now, ITER does this by using huge electromagnetic coils that contain superconducting wires that must be cooled by liquid helium. Now, from the looks of it, the design developed by the scientists has great promise, unlike Octo Octavius in Spider-Man there. And one hopes it could mean that in the next 5 years, ubiquitous, portable, safe energy plants just might be powering the future of the planet.
A rise in remote macOS workers is driving a cybersecurity rethink. With millions of people working from home due to the pandemic, the incidence of adware and potentially unwanted programs, or PUPs, is rising much faster on Macs, and Mac-based companies are encountering similar cybersecurity issues to their Windows-based counterparts. That's according to IC and security experts presenting at the annual Jamf Nation Users Conference this week. Now, historically, Mac users and their companies haven't had to worry nearly as much about malware as Windows users, but working from home has highlighted issues in managing remote Mac users. In a presentation on managing remote workers securely, the presenter estimated that 25 to 35% of office workers will work from home for the foreseeable future. Rather than expanding resources on creating cubicle farms, companies will focus on finding better ways to provision these workers, he said, noting that executives are increasingly describing the situation as, quote, show up when you want to, end quote. With a remote workforce, security can be more challenging for Mac-reliant companies, especially because the platform is becoming a greater target of attackers. Windows and Mac users see different threats, though. The vast majority of suspicious and malicious programs detected on Macs are adware and those PUPs, with malware accounting for only 0.3% of the detections. Yet, more work remains to better allow the platform to be remotely managed and secured.
Well, Washington State's emergency responders were the first to use SpaceX Starlink internet in the field. And they say it's amazing. The Starlink satellite internet network that SpaceX is developing has been used in the field by Washington State emergency responders in the recent weeks, the first early application of the company's service to be disclosed. Washington State military, which includes its emergency response division, began employing Starlink user terminals in early August to bring internet services to areas devastated by wildfires. User terminals are the small devices on the ground that connect to the satellites. The emergency division has 7 Starlink user terminals, which it is deploying with early success. Quote, I have never set up any tactical satellite equipment that has been as quick to set up and anywhere near as reliable as Starlink, according to Richard Hall, the emergency telecommunications leader of the Washington State Military Department's IT division, in a CNBC interview this last Monday. Basically, Starlink doubles the bandwidth in comparison, according to Mr. Hall. My comment is, considering just how much I've had to pay and how little bandwidth I got from first in Marsat and then Iridium, this is definitely a sea change, not only for emergency coordination and relief, but also for field science. I, for one, can't wait to see when I can snag a rig.
I really do have to get into the testing group for Starlink. Well, when it comes to our mobile devices, we're always looking for new and unique features that set the device apart from the rest, right? Well, organizations do this as well. They choose the devices for their people based on the features. Well, adding features like secure enclave storage or TPM or multiple SIMs adds appeal for organizations. What if I told you future Apple Watches or iPhones might warn users about poisonous gas or pollen in your local environment? Could be interesting, right? Could be compelling. Well, Apple has been coming up with ways to reliably sense the air using a combination of lasers and other sensors. While not something people think about, the air is an essential element of life, obviously, but it also could be potentially hazardous as well. Now, invisible issues could be in the air, such as pollen or poisonous gas, and with it, other potential irritants able to cause harm to a person if inhaled in sufficient quantities. Now, carbon monoxide detectors exist in the home in portable forms, but the compact versions aren't small enough to carry around easily. Ideally, adding a gas detector to an item a user carries around or wears every day, such as a smartphone or watch, could offer greater levels of protection by current systems, and the current systems are not capable of being able to embed it in such a way. Now, in a patent granted by Apple titled Particle Matter Sensors for Portable Electronic Devices, Apple suggests a solution to the problem by creating a component that can be installed into a device. Now, specifically, the patent deals with accurately detecting particulates in the air that are potentially hazardous. Now, self-mixing interferometers are actually systems used to detect objects' presence by reflecting laser lights on them. Now, the type of system can be affected by wind speed in this case, but sometimes, though, the component can be incorporated with a fan to create a fixed wind speed and direction, actually minimizing errors in that case. Now, an Apple solution to monitor the air proposes that the use of three lasers, three different sources of light, and three total internal reflection lenses, as well as relevant light sensors or photodiodes to receive the light. Now, the light emitted by the lasers is then fed through there, received to the receiving sensors, and light refracted towards the sensor itself provides the information. Now, Apple suggests using VCSELs, which are uses in the hardware such as iPhone's TrueDepth camera array to help with this. Now, the system uses the change in optical power emitted by each light source received by the sensor to determine the particulates and have crossed in front of the laser or not. Now, by detecting backscatter and reflection to the light beams, this can be used to determine the volume of the particulates in the air and what kind they are. Now, this is the first time Apple has looked into this issue about gas detection. In fact, in 2019, it suggested creating miniature gas sensors that could allow for compact hazardous gas sensors to include in the iPhone. Now, in August of that year, it meant using granular metal oxide semiconductor material sensors to detect multiple common gases. And then April of that year, Apple also proposed using gas sensors to perform simplified location detection. So based on the current trends, it seems like Apple is taking this type of technology quite seriously. So that means the next transition year for the Apple devices, including some of Apple's more advanced silicone, we might actually have devices that can provide even more telemetry for users about their physical environment. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Things Canary. Now, with everything that's going on in the world, Things Canary wants you to know they're here for you, especially in the current climate. Data breaches are on the rise, and companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised, and that's after spending millions of dollars on IT security. Well, Canary is designed to be installed, configured, and most likely forgotten in minutes. Now, when it comes to alerts, you only want the ones that matter. Well, that's where Canary's ability to provide you options helps. They give you the option to decide on what you, when and how you want to be told, whether it's email or text message right there on your console. It doesn't matter. Or even using collab services like Slack, webhooks, syslogs, or even just their API. Now, alerts should be dead simple, easy to work with, right? Conforming to your needs, not the other way around. And Things Canary has made that possible. You won't be overwhelmed by alerts. You'll get only the ones that matter. Now, think about this. When you think about data breaches, you should focus on these things. Hackers take the path of least resistance. Your staff, right? Your users. We say this all the time. It's definitely true. You need a way to ensure hackers don't ever get to take advantage of your users. Now, plus, if hackers do get in, it actually takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. That's a long time. That's why it's paramount you have a way to catch potential threats before they happen or when they're happening. This is where Canary comes in. Here's how Canary works. They are devices that sit on your network, and they look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers can't tell the difference. They look like the real thing, which hackers will think they're valuable, targetable assets for them to take advantage of. Then you can actually put fake files on them. You can enroll them in Active Directory. This means that they're indistinguishable from the real thing, making it a honeypot for just any type of hacker. Now, when the attackers actually investigate further, they give themselves away, and you can instantly get notified. Now, the company behind Things Canary, or the Canaries, has been in the security game for almost 2 decades. They've been training companies and militaries and governments on how to break into networks and have used that knowledge to build Canary. Now, Things Canaries are deployed all over the world on all 7 continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Now, I've tried this system out. It's amazing how simple it is to get started. All you have to do is simply add these devices to your network, and Canary handles the rest. That's really it. It's really that simple. Do your organization a favor. Get some of these right now. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance. And if you use the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love Thanks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Thanks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, when it comes to developing and deploying solutions, whether it be SaaS offerings or even line of business applications or integration apps, you need to ensure that the solution you're putting out there will work for your users, right? Well, this means ensuring that the new solution doesn't actually negatively impact their workflow, right? Whether they're advanced users, enthusiasts, or just people who are passive users. You want to make sure that what you're putting out there is not going to cause any impedance in their workflow. Now, one method of ensuring that is you can define your user's impact with using UAT environments or user acceptance testing. Now, you know, a lot of people have heard about agile methodologies, and that actually encourages user participation throughout the development process. Well, that includes the likelihood of positive results if you do that. Now, for most UAT testing, it's basically a last-ditch effort to catch issues with a deployment before it's deployed to all your regular end users. Well, the effectiveness of UATs can sometimes be watered down quite a bit by either the politics or even sometimes the project teams. Now, if you work in a large organization, you're probably familiar with such a thing, right, in such an environment. Now, the article here that we want to talk about today calls out several ways you can mitigate the red tape and amplify UAT's benefits for your deployments. Now, one of the steps it calls out is, number one, set expectations. Define up front what the user considers acceptable, right? What is the acceptable criteria of your service, your application? What is that? How do they feel like it would be help them in a way that you intended it for to help them? Now, when developers create a requirements doc, they think primarily about the establishing the application's needs to do what it must do to accomplish before the software goes to production. However, defining the acceptance criteria early as part of the requirements process helps you actually find hidden unspoken requirements and shows users what this testing stuff is all about. It actually shows what they're testing. Now, this is a level of user who discovers something they don't like. Now, sometimes they do, and whether it's a real problem or not, whether it's per spec or not, they usually promptly declare the entire product rubbish or based on a single point of observation. Now, they have no accountability but seemingly magical authority to send back the whole project to the drawing board and at the last stage of the game. Now, an acceptance test is a type of contract between the users or their representatives and the producers, saying in the essence, if you can do this, then the product is acceptable. Now, the next step here, really make it valuable. Put it someone in charge, obviously, right? We want to make sure that somebody's running the game here, especially from a UAT environment perspective. So setting up a UAT team, maybe a virtual team, a V team in that case, and it's individuals made up of multiple groups from different organizations, and they can help move things forward. They represent the different types of users that are already out there, the ones that are going to be using this thing, the ones that can produce those intents for you. And of course, finally, front load the discovery if the users will actually use what your software and services is doing. So make sure that your acceptance testing can make sure that new functionality will actually enhance, not hinder, not impede on business operations. And until a workable product is demonstrated for evaluation, the users may find it hard to actually understand the ins and outs of how their process will change once the software is deployed, which is what makes UAT a significant risk management effort. Now, my personal experience here, I'll tell you about that, because UAT is really sometimes hard to set up because it means that you either have to deploy a new ring somewhere of an application, and you have to have facilities and infrastructures to do that, or you provide a completely different environment focused at a set of users that will then go use it during their normal workday as if they were on the real system. And that can actually create quite a difficult system to set up. Now, many companies do this by they actually do a ring deployment where they have beta testers or beta test rings or fringe users. And some will actually copy their production environment to this other environment, and then they basically route specific users over there, and they give they have them test it that way. But either way, it takes planning and it takes quite a bit of effort. Now, that means having a separate team to tackle the plan for an environment is really paramount here. Now, I want to throw this to my co-host because obviously you guys have done this a lot. Cheever, you've done a lot of project management. You've done a lot of systems, done a lot of testing. How has UAT, have you used UAT? Does it impact your environment? Does it impact the outcome?
Actually, I didn't know it was called UAT back in those days. The process, one project I did was how to do automate the ID checks at gates for military bases. And because nobody really understood the process, what I started doing is I started making cardboard mock-ups that I could plaster little notepads on. And I'd go and take it to the MPs, and I'd say, how does this work? How does this work? How does this work? And I just slide little cards in there and sat down, and we actually developed the requirements that went to the contractor, the programming contractors. So we had user testing front-loaded into the project even before it went out to bid. And sadly, I retired, so I don't know how it turned out. But I see the wireless doodads whenever I go onto a military base. So the project apparently happened, and all the new IDs are smart cards. So in the back of the reader, you can actually take your smart card, stick it in, and it'll actually have the encrypted data to be able to check who you are and confirm that you are who you are, because it actually brings up a picture from the database. Kind of a cool thing. And user acceptance testing has, I think, probably made a really, really big difference in how usable that particular system was.
Right, right. So, Curtis, I want to throw this to you because, obviously you've worked with a lot of organizations. You've researched a lot of organizations. Do you feel like this is an acceptable way for organizations to get a better idea of whether their solutions are going to provide value or if it's going to be impedance on their users? Or do you think it could be just a way for testing to be pushed off on the users?
I think the answer to your question is yes. because I think that the answer to that is going to depend on exactly how an organization implements the idea. I think there are some who are perhaps strapped for resources in their development and testing organizations that will, in fact, look at this as a way to push testing off on the users. And they'll use either UAT or the example of many software publishers who have done something like that. I think done properly, this can be a money-saving step by organizations because it can shorten the time of uncertainty. And I think having the user representatives there can aid in creating good documentation and training programs. And as we all know, a major cost of implementing new or improved enterprise software is training the users to use it. If the first version of that software has significant flaws so that the users have to be retrained on what they were being retrained for, well, then your costs explode. So if you can do UAT properly and draw upon the data derived during UAT to shorten the process of training users during rollout, then I think you end up with a win-win because the quality of the software is better and the duration of the rollout period is shortened.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the interesting thing about UAT, like you said, it's all about how it's implemented. A lot of organizations, they do it in a little bit more of an interesting way. They do it, having beta rings or have people buy into beta rings. And then they put this out there and they sometimes grab a set of personas to say, okay, we need somebody in this field or this field, and have you verify the functionality and pass back the experience. And I think it's a really valuable way to do it. Obviously, I like the more targeted approaches where you provide a set of users from different personas that are more in a controlled environment and they go through their normal workday and then they provide direct feedback on that experience. I like that model. But again, there's lots of different models that work, and it really all depends on your scenario. Well, folks, that does it for that bite. We do want to move on to the next bite because I didn't actually know this because I always thought, hey, if you got ransomware on your machine, you either restore a backup or you either figure out a way to unencrypt or sometimes you have to pay the ransom. But in this case, sometimes paying ransom demands could land you in hot water. How's that going, Curtis?
Well, the answer is that we don't know how it's going to go because this is an advisory that has just been released by the Treasury Department. And basically what it says that is that if you pay a ransom for ransomware and the organization or individual to which you pay that ransom is in a nation that is on one of our restricted lists for commerce, then you could be guilty for violating a trade embargo with that country. And that's something that most people I know, if they're in the ransomware victim position, the last thing that they're worrying about is the home address of whatever group has gone and encrypted their data. Now, this is a really interesting twist on things. And you could say that this is the Treasury Department's way of encouraging organizations not to pay the ransom. You know, most government organizations have been saying for a couple of years, well, ever since ransomware became a big deal, that companies should not pay ransomware. That's, of course, easier said than done, especially if it's your customer or your patient data that's sitting locked up inside someone's encryption algorithm. So this will encourage them to think twice, at least, before paying the ransom. I think another thing that it's going to do is it's going to get the insurance companies involved in a much more direct way because, as we know, in many cases, the criminals seem to have a pretty good idea of the limits of the insurance policies that organizations have, and they will make a ransomware attack with a ransom demand that coincidentally is about what the limits of the organization's cyber insurance policy are. Well, if the insurance company is writing a check to the company that is, or the company, the attackers, and all of a sudden the insurance company is also perhaps on the hook for some of these civil penalties for breaking an embargo, well, that's going to change their willingness to write that check. Now, it's important to note that within the advisory, the Treasury Department said that the question of whether or not to levy these penalties might well rest on how cooperative the victim is with law enforcement. In other words, if the victim is working with law enforcement, keeping them apprised, and then there's the suggestion, well, just go ahead and pay the ransom, but give us, you know, the data on the transactions with the criminals, there might not be the harsh penalties. For those organizations that just blindly pay as a knee-jerk reaction, though, they could find that that penalty to the ransomware hijacker pales in comparison to the penalty they have to pay the Treasury Department. So, Lou, I'm going to turn to you. I mean, you deal with a lot of enterprise-level discussions. What do you think? Is this the sort of thing that you believe most CISOs are thinking about when they get the word that one of their systems has been hit by ransomware?
I think they're immediately scrambling, trying to figure out, well, you know, how am I going to mitigate this? How am I going to get rid of it? And I don't think they're thinking about, oh, well, who's going to sue me if I go pay to unlock my data and get my business processes running again, especially in the case of healthcare or any other situation. If you think about it, it's usually, hey, as fast as my system gets up and running, and, you know, the longer it takes for me to do that, the more money I lose. So if there's no failover or redundancy in the system or ways to restore backups quickly, you get into a conundrum of not being able to have business processes run. You have to do it manually. You have to do it in different ways. And we even saw people losing their life because of it. So I definitely think that CISOs and security experts, they're just not thinking about what the implications are of mitigating such a risk or such a hack. So I think it's almost like there needs to be some process in place that can help here, I think.
Well, Brian, I want to turn to you because, as we know, the Treasury Department, being a federal organization, can levy penalties against not only private enterprise, but against state and local governments. And we've seen a lot of these governments be involved in situations where they end up paying the ransom on ransomware. Universities are doing the same thing, often paying in order to get the data back rather than going through the process of trying to decrypt the data themselves. How do you think that university administrators and even local government officials are going to respond to this kind of threat hanging over them for breaking an embargo?
Actually, I think this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because I challenge anyone to be 100% sure, or even 99% sure, what country a ransomware person's really in. All these people are going to do their darndest to obscure where the heck they really are, because if they are in a country that supports extradition, yeah, no, someone's going to, the long arm of the law is going to go reach out to them. So are they really in Russia, or are they just making use of a server to bounce off Russia? So because it's not sure, I think the law or the rule is misguided. I think it needs to be rethought. And if they proceed, I think it's going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because it's not really well thought out.
It's hard to believe that there could be a government proposal that's not really well thought out, but there you have it. One way or another, I think Brian's right. We have, this advisory is not nearly the last word on this. We'll be seeing some news stories about this in the future, and when we do, we'll bring them to you here on TWiET. Well, speaking of bringing things to you on TWiET, we've got a great guest to bring to you. And to head us off in that direction, Lou, I'm going to hand it back over to you.
Thank you, Curtis. That's right. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on us. But before we get to that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's ZipRecruiter. Now, there's a lot to think about these days as an employer. Hiring can be a challenge, right? Especially when you have to think about enforcing social distancing and supplying masks. Well, Monica Starks could relate. She needed to hire for a pivotal role at her construction company, but was having a tough time finding the right person with so many candidates out there. So she switched to ZipRecruiter because they are making hiring easy. Now, ZipRecruiter's technology identifies people with the right experience for the job and actively invites them to apply, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TWiET. That's how Monica found Lamont Jenkins. She said that ZipRecruiter sent Lamont's profile to her around 5 minutes after she posted her job because he was a great match for the role. Now, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post in ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within just the first day. That's pretty impressive. Now, ZipRecruiter sends you the job of over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. Now, with the powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to the job. Now, there are a lot of organizations out there expanding during this period. Now, I posted a position just recently on ZipRecruiter that required a very specific skill. In other places, I wasn't really getting any hits here because it had a very specific skill set. Well, ZipRecruiter was able to connect me with candidates that had similar skills and the capacity to even develop the skills that I need, which is really impressive. Imagine being able to connect to a new opportunity where you can develop new skills just by entering your current ones. Think about that. They really have a great platform, and they just might connect you up with the next dream job or your next dream candidate. Now, ZipRecruiter makes the entire hiring process efficient and effective with the features like screening questions to filter out candidates
an all-in-one dashboard where you can actually review and rate your candidates at any point in time. See for yourself. Try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twiet. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TWIET, and that's ZipRecruiter.com/Twiet. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiet Riot. And today we have Nick Steck. He's the COO of WorkStorm. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Lou.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. I like to get started with origin stories because it's really compelling for the audience. And so can you maybe take us on maybe a short journey through tech and what brought you to WorkStorm?
Yeah, sure. So let me set the stage for what WorkStorm is first, pretty briefly, and then I'll kind of describe the story of how we got to it. So WorkStorm is a unified collaboration and communication platform. We focus on privacy and security. We're built for the remote worker to empower them and give them a simple unified interface to do their work. And we try to deliver a cost-effective solution to businesses for the management of those remote teams. So that's what WorkStorm is. How do we get to this point? My background, I was in the high-frequency trading business, building algos, doing quantitative research. I started as a trader kind of wrapped up my work I was ready to be done with high-frequency trading in about 2013 and looking for something, what to do next. There are a couple things that were interesting to me. It was investing. So instead of just the high speed, high frequency, kind of the intensity of trading all the time, I go over to investing instead. But also, as I was sitting and doing high frequency trading, there's a lot going on outside of the trading industry that was pretty interesting to me. Saw WhatsApp, saw Instagram get acquired, saw Apple, this idea of big data and working with a lot of data from trading, what was happening with big data and these other industries looked pretty interesting to me. So I was kind of focused on the investing side, but then a coworker of mine said this other guy, Raj Fernando, who's the CEO of WorkStorm and the founder, he had just recently sold his high frequency trading business, which was in the bond side. I was on the stock side, and he said he's doing something in the space that you might be interested in. Why don't you guys hook up together? So I met Raj Fernando, and he was building SaaS applications on cloud infrastructure with a remote group of workers, and could potentially create a lot of data with the problem that he was trying to solve, which was focused on something other than communication and collaboration, but was pretty interesting to me. So I hooked up with him, and I started to learn about that industry, learn about the technology and how to build applications, and we found out with the solutions that we were trying to solve that we really needed to get a user's time. And we needed to be where the user was in order to solve the problem and really get them to interact with our application. And we realized that in order to do that, we were going to either have to build a plugin to one of the systems where users are spending their time, which was back in 2016, email or messaging systems or project management systems. And instead of building a plugin to one of these applications, which we weren't sure which one is going to be a winner, how it's going to turn out, we decided let's just build it ourselves. So that's what we started doing. So WorkStorm has always been a remote company. We have a remote team, and we were using all kinds of technologies spread out all over the place. So we were using task and project management. We're using video conference solutions. We're using file storage, file sharing, we're using email, we're doing scheduling, we're using instant messaging. And we decided let's kind of try to build all of that, put that into a single platform. It'll be a very useful technology for us to use as a team. And then if we build something like that, then we can start to solve some of these other problems that we were interested in. But right, we really got into that problem itself. So you know, if Raj tells his side of the story, it will be in trading and high frequency trading, we never had a good way to communicate. So communication, you'd think high frequency traders were great at communication, but That's not quite the case. We're in a very heavily regulated industry, and there's a lot of reasons why we couldn't just adopt technology that was out in the consumer market. So we had a very restricted environment. And we thought, okay, these technologies are great that are out there in the market today, but we needed to build something that would actually work in the environment in which we were operating in. So we set about building these things with the set of requirements that we would need to use them in our own industry, which was heavily regulated. There were compliance requirements, data retention, data archiving requirements. There were ethical walls. Information couldn't just flow, be put on one system and go to everyone throughout the organization. And so we needed to create a system that was different, that did all of those things, that could create records for compliance and give compliance oversight and comfort to actually use these communication platforms. And it also needed to do not just all the kind of regulatory and compliance work, but it needed to be something different than what was being developed by the big tech companies. Big tech really was building an open collaboration platforms and still very focused on open collaboration. This idea that as you put more and more information onto a single system and single platform, the organization is going to become more efficient. People will be able to find easier people and information that they're looking for. Right. And that system wouldn't have worked at all for myself, wouldn't have worked at all for Raj Fernando, the CEO, because in the environment that we operated in, like, the people sitting next to me couldn't know what I was working on.
So really quick, Nick, I want to jump in really quick because I did want to talk about some of the topics you're bringing up. I think some interesting stories here. One of the things, obviously, we'll want to get into compliance too, because I think that's a really important one. But first, I think one of the things that might be compelling, especially for the audience here, is around remote work. You brought this up, but I wanted to dig into that a little bit more. Now, we've seen a lot of increased amount of remote work recently. Obviously, the industry is doing a lot more people out there. Critical mass has been hit here. We've talked a lot about it on here on Twyatt, but I did want to get your perspective. What are you seeing? What are the trends you're seeing from a remote work perspective? What's been changing, and how is WorkStorm actually helping here?
Okay. So what's changed was COVID obviously changed the kind of footprint for remote work, right? So prior to March, if we were explaining what we were doing and why our product's important and why you should kind of work a different way and get out of email and use these technologies, it was very difficult to explain to somebody the benefit and what was going on, and a compelling kind of use case for the application that would really be useful for the entire organization. Post-COVID, I think everybody kind of realized the benefit of this technology at the business level and at the worker level. Some workers are struggling. Some businesses are struggling with remote tech, but a lot of people are realizing the benefits of the technology. And what we saw from our own with our own experience was we built a bunch of different components that people could use, and we saw kind of an explosive use of the video conference technology being the most kind of important component of that platform. So it wasn't messaging. It wasn't a bunch of integrations with a bunch of different applications. It wound up to be the video conference technology because people were no longer together in the office and they really needed to have that FaceTime and they really wanted to connect culturally and work with other individuals to feel like they're together. And it was that video conference component that was really a key part to maintaining corporate culture and connection to the people that they're working with. So we shifted our roadmap very quickly to kind of focus on that and really beef up our video conference technology. But it's really been that shift within the kind of the different collaboration suite of options for people to operate that has really picked up since COVID. And we think that this is going to be permanent. I talked to a bunch of CIOs, CTOs who talk about reducing office space, corporate space, that they're leasing, that they're realizing the benefits of not having to host their own solutions or have as big networks and have remote teams. It's still challenging for them because the explosion of remote tech has created problems. There's now, depending on the solution that people are adopting, there's more data kind of sprawled all over the place. and right. management doesn't quite know if people are being productive or how they're being productive or how they're spending their time. And so there's struggles with really settling on the right remote work solution with the technology, and how do you manage that, and how do you review what people are doing, and how do you protect the data that's being proliferated on all kinds of different point solutions. And that's kind of, but yeah, so the choice for the worker, the kind of go-to solution has changed. And then the business side has to figure out, all right, how do we manage and how do we deal with this kind of remote reality that we're probably going to find ourselves in for the foreseeable future.
Right. Well, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about some technologies here that actually organizations can promote, maybe getting away from some of the traditional ones like email, where you have to have advanced threat protection, other things, and maybe moving into some of the more prominent ones that do consolidate into a single system so you can have more regulation. But we'll get to that, because I do want to talk about that more, and also bring them in my co-host. But before we get to that, I do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is IT Pro TV. Now, you're a busy professional. I'm definitely a busy professional. You probably don't have a lot of time to develop new skills, especially the ones you need to make a career change. Well, I've been in the tech field for a long time, and I can tell you, you need all forms of training when entering a new field. And IT Pro TV makes sure you have all the assets you need when it comes to learning IT. Now, if you're interested in the IT career but aren't sure where to start, IT Pro TV is the one-stop shop. It really is. IT Pro TV is the best online IT education platform where you can learn about IT from every kind of field. Government, managed services, healthcare, education, finance, insurance, IT, and many, many more. One of the best things about IT Pro is the fact that they make learning IT fun and entertaining. So you'll actually easily retain all the knowledge you apply in, actually apply it in real life on your real job. They have over 5,800 hours of IT training and 375 combined certifications, so you know you're getting the best IT education around. Now, if you're a manager looking to help develop skills of your IT team, IT Pro TV is just as valuable to you as well. They have every vendor and skill you need for IT training and your IT team training, and are the only official video training for CompTIA. Now, Microsoft IT training, Cisco training, Linux training, Apple training, security, cloud, and more. They have all of them in there. Track your team's results. You can prove the return on investment of your training spend with the pro portal that they provide. You can actually manage seats and assign unassigned team members and access monthly usage reports. Plus, you can see metrics like how many times login, what's the viewing time, what were the courses viewed. You can track completions and a lot more. In fact, you can easily manage your team. You can manage subsets of users or teams, provide them with customized assignments and progress. You can actually monitor their progress, and you can report usage of the platform. Assignments could be full courses or even individual episodes within the course. Check out their podcast, Tech NATO, with Don Pezet. He is featuring industry guests and IT news recaps for a deeper dive into the IT realm. Plus, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and IT Pro TV has hundreds of hours of cybersecurity training. Now, it's a great time to start a career in the industry with IT Pro TV. Now, whether you're looking to dive into a new IT field or you're expanding the skills of your IT team, IT Pro TV is exactly what you need. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, building or expanding your IT career and enjoying the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Nick Steck. He's the CEO of WorkStorm. And, you know, there's been a lot of trends going on. Like you said, we've seen a lot of organizations moving around and trying different technologies to adapt to the current time frame, the current period, a lot of remote workers and so on. And obviously, we're looking to secure things better. What have you seen? What have you seen? Obviously, a lot of organizations still pretty heavily working on email. A lot of their workflows are on email, so they have to incorporate things like advanced threat protection and other services to manage security here. Have you seen maybe a push more towards a unified collaboration platform, a place where you're doing more of the streaming type communication, the chatting, the like you said, the video, and collaborating there? Or are your organizations still traditionally using email, and is there a way to maybe integrate that? What are you seeing, Nick?
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on the organization and the industry. So some organizations are moving very rapidly and have already kind of moved most of their technology away from emails. Some are very heavily stuck in email, I would say, or not going anywhere from email anytime soon. One of the choices that we had to make when we were kind of building our collaboration suite was what to do with email. And we came to the conclusion that we needed to include an email client and a way to access the content that's being shared in email on the platform so that you can move it, say, from an email into a chat or into a task, take a file or take an email and share it within a different context. Because there's sets of workers and sets of workflows that are not going to be able to be teased away or pulled away from email anytime soon. And there are sets of workers of different demographics, maybe an older generation, who have spent 20 years of their life or more really perfecting their work around email and their email client and work very efficiently in it. And getting them to switch and transition would be a significant cost to that individual or that organization. But the younger people, there might be a generational gap between the type of technology they want to use, who want to stick into a messaging application, don't want to spend their time in email, don't want to build up that skill, but still need to communicate with the other workers across an organization that are there. And so there's kind of a generational gap and an industry gap. And depending on how much of the integrated tech stack has been built into add-ons and plugins to the email, there's a difference between how easily they can move off of email. Because when we talk about email, what is email, right? It depends on who you are, and it really comes down to how you use it. There's so many use cases within email that you can start to pick out bit by bit different use cases and put them into different applications. But there's still a lot going on within an email system.
So you talk a lot about open collaboration and systems that, you know, bring in these other legacy type things like email into one unified place. Is there more risk there, though, when you're bringing more of these information touch points into one system and now you're making it easy for them to access it? It's in one place, but then it could cause information leakage or other things that, you know, the easier you make it for them to do stuff like that, the more risk that you have there. Is there a way to mitigate that? Is there other things that they can do?
Sure. So the way that we brought in our email and calendar integration onto our platform is client to client or client to API and the other system that you're talking to, so that it either mm-hmm. doesn't pass through our cloud infrastructure and it doesn't get stored on our infrastructure. If you could bring it in another way where that provider who's providing the integration is actually touching that data or storing that data, can create a greater risk, right, to the information moving off of the kind of self-contained system and network with all of the kind of protection and security built around it. And now you've just given that data to some other third party system. So yeah, you definitely need to kind of look at the details of how integrations are built when you're building a unified platform to figure out where that data actually is residing and who's in control of that data and who has access to it.
That makes sense. Well, I do want to bring my co-host in. Chibra, I'll throw it over to you first.
I'm curious. You know, we're talking about some really interesting things on linkages and so forth, but I worry a little bit. This day and age, we're getting more and more regulatory issues involved. In education, it's FERPA. In medicine, it's HIPAA.
Correct.
You know, there's some things that are coming up in Starbucks and so forth. What kinds of things have you built in for auditing to make sure that we can stay compliant with this new regulatory world?
Sure. So one of the industries that we kind of initially started discussing who would have similar kind of concerns as a trading background was the legal industry. And we spent a lot of time talking to the kind of CIOs and CTOs there to learn how they were managing records and how they were managing their data. And we knew what we had to build to service that industry, which was kind of compliance modules that would give companies the ability to look at content or block content or monitor content, to take that content and integrate it with an archiving system. So something like a SMARSH, or in the financial industry, it was Global Relay, some other system that would take the content or even a document management system. In the legal industry, it was iManage. And take the content out of our platform, create a record for it, export it to one of these other systems, and then they could continue to do all of the compliance and monitoring and this other software that was already part of the system, a part of their tech stack, they could continue to do that there as they brought in another piece of software that was another source of content.
So one thing I'm actually interested in, Nick, is, a lot of this seems to be, especially during this period, there seems to be kind of a crowded space, a lot of different systems out there that are trying to bring together organizations. You have, obviously the Slacks of the world and the Zooms of the world and the Microsoft Teams collaboration service of the world. What is your system doing that's setting itself apart? Like, what is it doing differently? How is it handling things differently that can maybe be more appealing to some organizations?
Sure. So we kind of built around this idea of private collaboration, where information shouldn't be just shared on one system or shipped off to AI systems to train the AI systems, that it should be really shared on a need-to-know basis. So think about a Teams experience. Maybe it's all the teams, all the channels are already reestablished and set up. So if a new user comes onto the platform, they immediately have access to this whole set of conversations and content. Whereas on a WorkStorm, you bring in a new user, their space might be empty and they start to need to be invited and connected to the people who have access to the information, and they dynamically and agilely kind of become a part of that organization and only get access to the areas that they need to know. It's because we kind of built our platform that way, with not just open collaboration where all the silos are broken down, but more private. It's been very easy for people to bring in external members from the organization. So whereas some of these platforms are really good and built for internal use cases, once you start to bring in external parties, there's a risk that they might get access to all of this content inadvertently. And so a platform that's a bit more siloed, where you have to be invited to the conversations and it's harder to access or search for relevant content, there's a lot more comfort level that you could bring in an external development team, bring in a client, and begin to collaborate with them on their private information without a risk of exposing it to the rest of the organization.
Fantastic. Nick Steck, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little low on time. I want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where their organization go, where can they go to learn more about WorkStorm and some of the new offerings you guys got?
Yeah, WorkStorm.com is a great place to learn. There's a website there. There's help pages. There's help content. I would start your search there.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another Out of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt, of course. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our geek in paradise. He's that geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
I'm trying to get some final quotes on what it's going to cost to move my household goods from Kaneohe, Hawaii over to Orlando, Florida. Looks like I'm going to start the timer pretty soon. Anyway, I would love to hear from you. I want to hear your ideas for shows. I want to hear your comments on shows. If you feel like complaining about whatever you think about, be a little nice about it, but we still want to hear those. There's lots of room for improvement. We would love to hear it. So I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter, Advanced Net Lab, or Chibert at twit.tv. And Chibert is spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. My students and I had a Dilbert naming theme, and they all decided I should be Chibert. But you know what? It's probably better for you to use Twyatt at twit.tv, because then it hits all the hosts for Twyatt. Would love to hear from you. And your ideas have been spectacular. And I'm a booking madman. Thanks, and see you next week.
That you are, Chibert. Thanks, Chibert. Well, of course, we have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over at Dark Reading. Curtis, you have a busy couple weeks, right? I think, there's a trade show coming up pretty soon, right?
There is indeed. This coming week is Interop. That's Interop Digital. Lots of good stuff going on there. A lot of training, a lot of great sessions. And if you'll follow me on my Twitter account over at KG4GWA, I will later this weekend and for the first part of the week. I have some discount codes if people have been trying to decide whether or not they want to attend. We might help you make up your mind. Also going to have some great articles coming out over at Dark Reading, including The Edge of Dark Reading, starting with one on some best practices for keeping WordPress safe. You know, WordPress is used in something like a third of all of the websites on the internet. Might as well keep it safe if it's going to be that popular. Got some more great things coming up, including sort of a look back from a researcher I know and respect, someone who has well over 300 CVEs to his credit, talking about what life was like before the CVE system and how getting a CVE registered has changed from 1999 until today. So plenty of stuff going on. Follow me at KG4GWA. Follow me on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin. And we'll see you over at Dark Reading.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Curtis. Appreciate it. Well, folks, we also thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and get your enterprise news. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your IT pro and enterprise news. Now, go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll all find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, of course, all the links we do during the show, the stories we do in the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download and subscribe links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcast applications, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, you name it, we're on it. Subscribe. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, plus it's the best way to support us as well. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we talk about a lot of great fun technology topics on the show, and I guarantee they'll find it interesting too. So definitely share it with them. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the day, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, we do this show live. So come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the behind the scenes. That's live.twit.tv. We're on it right now. It's a really great place to be to watch us live. But if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well interact with the show live as well. You can interact with us, the co-host, the guests, everybody, including our great chat room, irc.twit.tv. Go there, sign in quick and easy, use an alias, whatever you want. Jump in there, have a great discussion with all the greatest characters in there. We have really great discussion in there and some great questions come out of it. So definitely be in there. So that's irc.twit.tv. And of course, if you can't watch the show live, we also have a great website out there, twit.community. That's right, twit.community. It's a great website. We have the entire community is out there, 24/7 discussion about technology, about the show topics that we just talked about. All the shows are out there. All the hosts are out there. Go check it out. It's a really great place to have a great discussion. And it's available 24/7. So check it out. Now, remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. I have great conversations with people like you. And, of course, I also talk about my work week, of course, too. I work at Microsoft. And there I talk about all the latest and greatest ways to make your office suite more productive for you by customizing it, by using the Office platform. So check it out. You can check that out at developers.microsoft.com/office. There you'll find all the latest and greatest ways to customize your Office solution. But I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Definitely, we can't do this show without these people, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really thank them for their support. Thank you so much, Leo and Lisa. Of course, we thank all the engineers and the staff at Twit. Of course, thank you again. I want to thank one more time Mr. Brian Schiebert. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He's doing all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we couldn't do the show without him. So thanks again, Schiebert, for all your support and all your help throughout the ages here. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor behind the scenes. He makes us look good, Mr. Victor. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. He is the man of many talents. Ant, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm unbelievable as always, but I did have a little bit of PTSD when you started talking about UAT and ITT, because that's my former life.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it's definitely a good model. Well, hopefully we'll get into another discussion of it in the coming future. Maybe you could be on. We can have you on as a guest, too.
Maybe. I'd rather people just check out Hands-On Wellness and Hands-On Photography.
There you go. Thanks, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Want more Twit? Well, you gotta check out iOS Today. That's the show where Leo Laporte and I cover everything you need to know about iOS. It's the best apps, the best games, and everything you can do with your iPad, your iPhone, and your Apple Watch, plus CarKit and so much more. twit.tv/iOS.